listeners, and welcome to this episode of Cell and Gene, the podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Harris, and I'm happy to introduce to you my guest for this episode, Dr. Ahmed Enayatullah, Senior Vice President, Head of Development at Blue Rock Therapeutics, a Cambridge, Massachusetts-based clinical stage cell therapy company that develops therapies for treating people living with degenerative diseases. Ahmed, thanks for being here. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Aaron. Happy to be here.
Good. Okay. So I just briefly explained Blue Rock Therapeutics, but I would love to hear from you what Blue Rock Therapeutics' mission is and a little bit about your pipeline.
No, absolutely. And again, thank you for that opportunity. So Blue Rock is a cell therapy company. It's a wholly owned subsidiary of Bayer. And, you know, our mission at Blue Rock is really we're trying to transform the way we treat, you know, degenerative diseases. You know, we work on creating cell therapies and really address a huge unmet need for diseases where, you know, the central pathology or, you know, a core element of the disease progression is losing cells to damage or degeneration. In events like that, you know, the standard of care doesn't really help much because it doesn't replace the lost cells. Standard of care in such diseases, and I'm talking here broadly and generally, is usually to alleviate, you know, the symptoms or maybe leverage the remaining cells to compensate for the cellular damage. And the way we do that in Blue Rock is really based on, you know, some of the relatively recent advances in the stem cell research and technology. Essentially, now we're able in the field to obtain stem cells, which you can consider them almost like a blank canvas, and create any type of cell in the body, including highly specialized cells. And, you know, being able to do that, then you can, you know, start thinking about diseases where cell loss or cell damage is a primary cause, and then you go and replace the cells. And that's hopefully how we attempt to, you know, transform treating such diseases. Mm-hmm. I can tell you more about the pipeline. At Blue Rock, we have four therapeutic areas. We have neurology, cardiology, ophthalmology, and immunology. In the neurology space, our lead program is for Parkinson's disease, and this is the one that you probably, you know, saw the news. We just announced the 18-month data, which we presented at ADPD a couple of weeks ago, I believe. And then in ophthalmology, we're targeting inherited retinal diseases as our first indication in that therapeutic area. And again, this is a group of diseases characterized by loss of photoreceptors, which essentially are the cells responsible for transforming, you know, the light or the light energy to a signal that we can perceive or our brains can perceive. And our goal is to go and replace the lost photoreceptors in this group of diseases, inherited retinal diseases. And after that, you know, we're targeting cardiology, and we're targeting, you know, a huge unmet need there. If you think about cardiac events in which patients, you know, essentially lose up to billions of cells of cardiomyocytes, and they end up with, you know, a cardiovascular disease, be it heart failure, for example, and you know, cardiomyocytes don't really regenerate, which is typical to a lot of the degenerative diseases we talk about. You know, once you lose the cells, you lose them, the body is not able to repair or regenerate them or make them again. So we're targeting, you know, such diseases with cardiomyocytes, essentially fresh, healthy cardiomyocytes to replace the lost ones and restore function. And then the last therapeutic area we have is immunology. Immunology, we're focusing on, you know, Tregs, which is essentially regulatory T cells. They play, you know, very complex, you know, roles in multiple, you know, areas. And physiologically, I mean, they maintain, you know, the immune system. But But there is a huge opportunity here for autoimmune diseases where Tregs can actually be used to help with that group of diseases. So we are, again, still in a preclinical stage of doing research on Tregs, but that's our fourth therapeutic area.
Good, great. Thank you for that explanation of your pipeline. And for the purposes of our episode today, we're going to be talking about specifically your work around Parkinson's disease. And we will get to that wonderful news that was shared at the conference, which we'll get into in a little bit. But before we do, I want to sort of level set the conversation a little bit and explain kind of the latest in Parkinson's disease. And what I mean by that is for patients, you know, living with Parkinson's disease, what is their best course of treatment currently?
It's hard to answer that, but let me try and get at that. But before I get to the treatment, let me try to explain a little bit about the disease because it will help addressing the treatment question. So Parkinson's disease is a neurological disease that, you know, it primarily affects, you know, patients' ability to control movement, right? So there's a lot of shaking, stiffness, you know, balance, difficulties, and so on. And the pathology behind it is really a neurodegeneration that is progressive and it worsens over time. And the loss of dopaminergic neurons in a certain part of the brain has been identified as, you know, a central component of such pathology. In fact, in most patients, by the time they're symptomatic, it's estimated that about 60 to 80% of such neurons have been lost already. So that's kind of, you know, Parkinson's disease. And I think levodopa, which is, you know, the mainstay for treating Parkinson's disease, was discovered back in the 60s or 70s. Until today, it remains really, you know, the central component of the now, since then, a lot of formulations and routes of administration have been developed. So you have new advanced formulas and routes of administration, but still it's all about levodopa for the most part. There are other, you know, medications for Parkinson's as well. But the reason I mentioned that, because if you think about it, the way levodopa works, it's essentially leveraging, you know, the remaining neural networks, you know, by trying to push them harder to compensate for the lost dopaminergic neurons. But it doesn't really affect the disease progression. So patients continue to lose dopaminergic neurons over time, and the effectiveness of, you know, the current standard of care or the current treatments, you know, wanes over time. So it's typical for patients to respond early on, and sometimes people call it the honeymoon period, where, you know, the standard of care is providing, you know, I guess it's addressing the symptoms in a way that makes patients, you know, pretty much function close to normal or normal. But then over time, that goes away. Now, more recently, relatively, I guess, you know, there are advanced treatments that are being, you know, brought to the field. You know, advanced surgical therapies such as DBS and even, you know, more advanced ways of administering levodopa so that you get like a more constant level rather than the peaks and troughs of, you know, oral medication. Yeah, these are all things that help. But again, similarly to what I just said, patients continue to lose dopaminergic neurons. So anything that works by or relies on the neural networks, you can imagine that effect goes away over time or wanes over time. So that's really what we're trying to address, is that can we do something to address the progressive nature of the disease and to address that central characteristic of the disease, the loss of dopaminergic neurons, and essentially transform the way we treat, you know, Parkinson's patients. So that's how we look at it. I'm trying to think if there is, anything that, of course, we can talk about gene therapy, which is another approach, right? But nothing approved there, but there's a lot of research ongoing. But that's about summarizes what's going on in the treatment of Parkinson's right now.
Good, good. Okay. And thank you for that. Now, your pipeline, you mentioned this at the top of our discussion. Your pipeline and approach primarily focus on induced pluripotent stem cells or iPSCs. So I guess the main question is why iPSCs?
Yeah, so maybe again, I'll provide a little bit of background and then we can get to why iPSCs kind of help clarify. But if you think about it, I mean, the idea of cell therapy actually is not new. It's a very old one. And if we go back in history, blood transfusions, which I guess almost a century now, it's a form of, cell therapy. But it wasn't until recently, I think like back in the 80s and 90s, when research showed us that you can actually use mouse embryonic stem cells and even larger animal embryonic stem cells like monkeys. And you can use them to create virtually any type of cell, right? So, if you think actually about embryogenesis, like the formation of an embryo, right? That's the beginning, right? You start after fertilization, you start with stem cells, that blank canvas that then differentiates into all the different cell types that make up the organs of, the body we see, even like the adult body. The challenge is with such stem cells over time in adults, you lose the majority of stem cells and you lose the ability of, such cells to divide and self-renew and differentiate in many of the organs. For example, the heart and, and the brain and the muscle. And that becomes a challenge. So when you have a degenerative disease or damage to, one of the organs where the stem cells are not programmed to regenerate or to replenish, the cell loss, then you have the degenerative diseases we're talking about. Now, with the ability or with the discovery of, stem cells and essentially, early on, it was embryonic stem cells. But then, later on, I believe it was, 2012 or so, the Nobel Prize discovering not only you can take embryonic stem cells and convert them or have them differentiate into virtually any cell type, you can actually take adult cells, convert them to stem cells. So now you have this blank canvas that's iPSCs, right? Induced pluripotent stem cells. And now you can differentiate, iPSCs in virtually any type of cell. So you can imagine this is, it's a huge breakthrough. And it's essentially what's, triggering and motivating the incredible amount of research that we see today in the field. And being able to do that, you can address many things in the area that even when people thought about cell therapy in the past, concerns around scalability, right? Being able to obtain the cells, to make the cells, to differentiate the cells at a scale that's consistent with the patient populations we're able to address. If you're talking about the quality, if you're talking about the consistency. So with all the advances and everything that I just described, BlueRock, we found ourselves in this space where there was enough advancement in the technology, enough understanding of the biology. There is this huge unmet need. We developed our own capabilities to be able to make the iPSCs and then re-differentiate them into virtually any cell type. And that's essentially our platform. And there is a lot to go into that. And then on top of that, we have what we call cell plus gene platform. Not only you can make fresh, healthy cells to replace lost cells or damaged cells, you can actually modify them or enhance them in a way that makes sense based on the disease we're trying to target. So you can imagine not only you're making the cell type you want, but you can add some feature to it that helps with, you know, that approach. So that is what makes it appealing. You know, the technology we have today, enough understanding, we have the technology, we have understanding of the biology, and then the huge unmet need, we're doing something that, you know, none of the current modalities really can do. And that's how we arrived at iPSCs, and that's why it's a primary platform for Blurock.
Good, good. Okay, and thank you for taking that, you know, extremely complex and making it, you know, digestible in 2 minutes. So I appreciate that. All right, and that's what I want to talk about next, which is, in fact, the wonderful news that your phase one clinical trial for Parkinson's disease, in the news we know, continues to show positive trends at 18 months. So talk us through the significance of this, and then, you know, what are the promising steps that for further study for this?
Yeah, so I think, you know, in Parkinson's disease, actually, multiple attempts have been made in the past to use cell therapy, right? And again, very different from what we're doing today, and using different sources and different types of cells. But based on that, I think we learned a lot. We learned that there is this huge potential of using cell therapy to, you know, address the huge unmet need for Parkinson's. And at BlueRock, we built on that. Of course, everything I mentioned before, you know, understanding the biology, understanding the very specific type of cell lost in Parkinson's disease, having that being, you know, a main characteristic and central to the pathology and progression of Parkinson's disease. So, you know, what we're doing is essentially produce at scale dopaminergic neuronal progenitor cells to replace the cells lost in Parkinson's disease. What do I mean by, you know, dopaminergic neuronal progenitor cells? What we actually transplant is cells that are committed to become dopaminergic neurons, but they're not fully mature yet. And by doing so, when we transplant them, they continue to differentiate and integrate and recreate the neural networks lost to Parkinson's disease, and then essentially restoring the function in such networks and helping patients regain control over, I guess, the movement disorders or challenges they have, and regain control over their lives. So that's, I guess, what we're trying to do. Now, you can imagine there are a lot of hurdles to get to that point, and really that's what I'm trying to address here, all the way from the research required to get to a first-in-human study with such a novel approach, right? So we're, you know, this is uncharted waters, right? Like, we're doing something that it's not well-established, whether we're talking about making the cells, scaling up the cells, whether we're talking about how you prepare them, how you administer them. We're talking about a neurosurgical procedure here. So it is literally neurosurgery. and then, of course, we have to do that, you know, very carefully, you know, and whether we're talking about the right patient population and how we do it and the kind of follow-up to be able to get, like, useful information to decide the next steps with this approach. So we were able to go through all of that and get to the phase one that we're talking about now. And in this phase one, we enrolled 12 patients, 5 patients in the low dose group and 7 patients in the high dose group. And we, you know, when we started this program, you know, we were set to answer 4 questions essentially around everything I mentioned now. One is the safety, which is the primary objective of the phase one study. Looking at the safety of the cells, the safety of the procedure, the safety of, you know, even the immunosuppression, you know, that we're using, you know, in the first year. And then the second question is around the feasibility of this approach. You know, can we identify the patients? Can we, you know, perform the stereotactical surgeries that, you know, we're using here? Do patients get, you know, the targeted number of cells? Do patients have, I guess, the entire experience, you know, from the surgery, hospitalization, discharge, and all of that? And then the third piece is, target engagement. So we're using a type of imaging that can detect dopaminergic signal in that part of the brain where we put the cells. And we want to know if the cells actually survive and integrate and can produce that, you know, dopaminergic signal or not. And then lastly, we included exploratory clinical endpoints to see if there are any trends. And again, it's phase one. So when I say exploratory, it is truly exploratory, just based on the number of patients and being uncontrolled and open label. We have to be careful not to overinterpret that. But I think, you know, the excitement for us and the data we shared, you know, a couple of weeks ago at ABPD in Lisbon, is that the answer to all four questions is yes, right? So we have a favorable safety profile. We have, you know, feasibility. We're able to administer the intended targeted, you know, number of cells to all patients. And we do see increase in dopaminergic signal in the parts of the brain where we transplant the cells. And the clinical trends, you know, are promising, right? We're seeing, you know, improvement that seems to be dose-dependent, time-dependent, consistent across multiple endpoints, whether it's patient-reported, clinician-reported, and then, of course, you know, having the consistency between the exploratory clinical endpoints and the PET imaging, which is, you know, I guess what we call target engagement. Like, we see evidence that the cells are there, they're surviving and doing what we expect them to do. So when you see that picture, the totality of the evidence supports moving on to the next stage, which is going into a larger study with, you know, a controlled study in that case, to further confirm the safety profile we're seeing today, but to actually more robustly test the efficacy component, the exploratory clinical endpoints, in that case, will be more central in a phase two study. Couple of things to add to the excitement for the last data cut, the 18-month data we shared. I think I mentioned early immune suppression, but I didn't really talk about it much. Because we're using cells that are not obtained from the same patient, from the host, right? So we have the cells which we scale and produce and, you know, virtually have, you know, unlimited supply of. You know, there is a concern, especially building on some of the previous work in that space in Parkinson's, that the body will reject the cells. And that could be a, you know, a major challenge. So, you know, based on prior work and, you know, our own efforts, we decided to go with the immunosuppression regimen that we have in the study. Essentially, all patients get immunosuppression from the time of surgery up till 1 year. And at 1 year, you discontinue the immunosuppression. And that's why the last endpoint or the last data point we looked at, 18 months, is crucial, because it's 6 months after discontinuation of immunosuppression. And of course, the major question, do you now all of a sudden lose, you know, the dopaminergic signal on the PET image? Do you start losing, you know, the exploratory clinical endpoints? And we're excited to say, no, if anything, you know, the trajectory of the improvement on the exploratory clinical endpoints continues. The PET, you know, dopaminergic signal is still there. So that makes it even more significant for us. And of course, the longer the duration and the more data you accumulate, you know, the better you inform future studies and the future path for the entire program. So that's, in summary, I guess, the 18-month data that we shared a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, it's such wonderful news. That's and so promising. And when can we expect the phase two study?
It's planned for later this year. And yeah, that's all I can provide at this moment.
Right. Sure. But before we kind of formally end the discussion, I wanted to talk a little bit about verdonoprosol, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, but your investigational pluripotent stem cell, stem-derived cell therapy candidate. If you could talk us through that and what it is and an explanation of it.
Yeah. And I think maybe I can expand on that. I mentioned a little bit. So bempedoic is essentially that dopaminergic neuronal progenitor cells. So that is the drug product. And it's really taking PSCs and differentiating them to that state, you know, and then from there you transplant them in the putamen of Parkinson's patients bilaterally. And they are progenitors. So they are not the fully differentiated mature dopaminergic cells yet. But you know, what we were able to show in preclinical models, and now with the phase one data, we can say that too, is that once you put them in the brain, they continue to differentiate. They are committed to that cell type, right? So they continue to differentiate. They become the dopaminergic, you know, neurons lost to Parkinson's disease. So essentially, we are providing patients with, you know, a healthy supply of neurons that they lost to the disease. Of course, it takes time for the cells to finish maturation, differentiation, and to integrate with the neural network. So that's the description. And also, maybe I should add that the 18-month data that we shared, it does support the hypothesis that for the differentiation and full integration, it takes time. So we actually expect that, you know, the signal and the improvement, you know, to continue to go up over time. Some of the earlier studies done with, you know, other types of cell therapy show that it could take up to 3 or 4 years to reach the maximum potential of that. So that's bempedoic, which are dopaminergic neuronal progenitor cells.
Good, thank you. I appreciate the detailed explanation. Okay, so we've reached, like I said, the formal end of our discussion, and I like to talk to my guests about who they are when they're not developing life-saving therapies. And so, like you, I am in the Northeast as well, and was wondering, what do you prefer to do with your free time now that the weather is more agreeable for us? But then I realized that when I asked that, perhaps you're someone who really enjoys winter, and this is not the best time. So, you know, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's free time is an interesting concept, I guess. But I do actually, you know, I do make sure that I have free time, and I spend most of my free time with my family. You know, the entire family, you know, we love hiking, we love outdoor activities. So whenever the weather is, you know, cooperating, not today probably, but, you know, last week, we do spend time outside. You know, we love to go to like new hiking places all the time and explore, you know, some of the new places around New England here. So yeah, that's what we do. And in the snow, I can't call us a snow family really, but we do enjoy, you know, some of the snow activities as well.
I think unless you are an allergy sufferer, the springtime air is the best. And
spring is amazing. Yeah.
I'm not a winter person, so I'm thrilled that the warmer temperatures are.
Yeah.
Or soon, hopefully.
Getting there.
Yeah. All right, listeners, that wraps up this episode of Cell and Gene, the podcast, featuring Dr. Ahmed Enayatullah. And so, Ahmed, thank you so much for your time. This was great.
Thanks, Erin. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in, listeners. Please subscribe and ask your peers to do the same. And we will talk to you soon.